The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Okay. So this morning I'd like to talk about this path of development that we have in this Buddhist tradition here. But I'd like to look at it from a little bit different angle. But to start with, I think it's kind of unique. It's not entirely unique, but one of the, maybe I'll say, interesting features about this Buddhist path and this particular tradition is the idea that it's a path. It's something that we do, that there's like kind of specific steps, and they don't always go in order, 1 through 10, but that there are different methods or things that we can learn. And this isn't surprising, right? Because the same thing is true for learning a new skill, any new skill. Learning to swim. They don't first just throw you in the deep end and say, well, make sure that you do alternate breathing between left and right. Right? I mean, they kind of start with learning to float and then learning to kick or things like this. As well as in the early Buddhist literature, there's lots of references to people who are fletchers, who make arrows. There's people who are washermen, who I guess help prepare the baths, maybe communal baths. There are people who pot makers. You know, so it's a very common thing to learn a new skill and to have a person who has a skill. And of course, maybe the most obvious path of development is this idea of children growing up, right? It's something that we all went through, and perhaps we've parented and we've helped others go through, but it's, you know, different stages. Somebody who's 3 years old is not the same as somebody who's 30 years old. That's so obvious, but yet there was a way in which these things happened. So instead of talking about the specific elements of the path, I'd like to talk about two things that are implicit about being on a path, of development, a path of maturation, a path of growing, of learning something new. And one is this idea that it takes a village. It's kind of like shorthand for this African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. My understanding of this is that it's right, it's not only what happens exactly in the home or in the school, but it's also depends on what's happening in the community, whether it's the immediate community, extended family, or the larger community of the village. And the second thing that I'd like to talk about today is this idea of kind of have this word that gets translated into English as being tameable. So we'll start with this idea of it takes a village. Some of you may be familiar with the Kalama Sutta. This is a sutta that was delivered to the people who lived in the city called Kalama. And the story is that there are a number of religious teachers that were coming through town and were saying, you must do this, and this way is the only way, and every other way is terrible and awful. And then they would leave town. And then another religious teacher would show up and say, probably like the opposite, you must do this, and you must not do that. Not surprisingly, the citizens of Kalama were confused, and they asked the Buddha, well, how do we know? There's all these people that are coming here and talking to us, saying contradictory things, claiming they're the truth, and how can we tell? How can we tell who has the truth? And then when Dharma teachers talk about this, they often give what's next, that the Buddha gives us instructions. I don't have it memorized, I don't know it exactly, but something along the lines of, well, don't follow things just because it's tradition. Don't follow things just because somebody told you. Don't follow things just because it makes sense on your limited understanding. But what I like to focus on is what he says next, what the Buddha says next. And he says, so first, he, as I described, he talks about what not to do, but here the question is what to do. When you yourselves know these things are unskillful or unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censored by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, then don't do them. That seems pretty straightforward. If these things are unskillful and unwholesome, blamable, censored by the wise, and leave to unpleasant results, then don't do them. But what's implicit in this, this idea of what's blamable and censored by the wise, means you have to be part of a community. You kind of have to know, like, what if you were to do it, others would think is blamable. Others would say, oh, you just did something that goes against our cultural norms, that goes against our ideas of morality, that go against our understanding of how to be in community. It also says, don't do things that are censored by the wise, that the wise people don't commend, don't condone. So that also requires that not only are we in community, but we recognize who are those people that are wise. And somewhere in the suttas, I'll give an example, but I think that we could imagine that somebody who is wise, quote unquote, to somebody who has been practicing for a while, somebody who is learned, knows the suttas, or has listened to a lot of Dharma talks, listened to Dharma, or read Dharma books, perhaps. Somebody who seems sensible. Somebody who seems clear-headed and clever in the way that, not clever in being able to negotiate themselves in and out of things, but clever in terms of like can figure things out, like, oh, right, I see how this is related to that. That's how we can find somebody who is a wise person. Often these people are maybe what we would consider elders, quote unquote, in the community. Not old in terms of their age, their physical age, but those who are recognized by others as kind of being senior in the community. In the time of the Buddha, there was a real emphasis on this, on those people who had ordained longer than others, kind of the ones who had been in the community longer, had ordained longer, would teach those who were new. This makes perfect sense, right? That usually when we go to high school, the people who are teaching the high school students have already graduated from high school and have probably already graduated from college. In the same way, professors have already graduated from college and so on, right? People have completed a certain training before they teach others. So this idea of knowing what to do requires identifying those who are wise in our community and knowing what is blamable, what would those wise people say? And it also implies that we're part of community. But it also says, so in this Kalama Sutta, know those things that are unskillful or unwholesome, those things that are blamable, things that are censored by the wise. And he goes on to say, undertaken and observed, those things that lead to harm and ill. So not only do we need to know kind of what other people think about it, we need to anticipate what will the results be if we do an action. And knowing the results, kind of like fully evaluating that, requires that we anticipate, imagine perhaps, what will be the consequences not only to ourselves, but to others. Will it harm others? Will it benefit others? Will it harm ourselves? Will it benefit us? then ideally it would benefit both others and ourselves. So this is kind of another way in which practicing in community kind of support us on our developmental path in this the Buddhist tradition here. And then there's a whole teaching about, it's called a wise attention, yoniso manasikara in Pali, the language of the early scriptures, that are a skill in itself to learn how to do this, how to be in community and how to anticipate the results of our actions. But of course, in our villages, quote unquote, there are some people that are wise and some people that are less wise. And first we can define village. In my view, I can define village. It's a little bit of a circular argument, but those that influence us. And so that includes the media, our family, our work environment, our practice community. And I know I'm certainly influenced by the media. I saw this recently when there was some news that was really upsetting. There's been enough of this lately, but I found myself so sucked into, like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And I found myself going on the internet, checking Google News, like every 15 minutes, every half hour. I was at my computer already, and I was doing some work, and I had to check, like, oh my gosh, did they know anything new? And I just got so tense and wrapped up in it. I don't think that's supportive of my practice. It's not benefiting me, and it's not helping me to benefit others. But the media has a way, right, where they kind of want to, it's their job, it's their intention to pull us in and want us to be hooked. And it's easy to do, right? They're professionals. There's probably PhD psychologists who are helping them figure this out, how to help us get hooked.
They may be just working on the assumption that you already are hooked, just rolling with it.
Excellent point, right? It's not only them that are making us hooked, right? I mean, you can't help but when you're growing up in the society to be hooked by different things, as well as, right, all of us have a certain amount of greed, a certain amount of lust. It's part of the human condition. We also have some aversion, so they can maybe like tap into that and want to, you know, flame it, or what's the word, like fan the flames of that and make it bigger. So they're not creating something that's not already there, but adding to what's already there. So our village includes the media, but it also includes, you know, family and friends. And In the Buddhist suttas, there's this one little expression that I actually like to kind of help guide or help to influence with whom we are looking to be the wise or to guide us. This, that one who is herself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is impossible. That one who is not herself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is possible. Right? This makes sense. Just that somebody, all of us may be sinking in the mud in different types of mud, right? It's not like one person is wholly in the mud about one aspect. But, you know, there may be somebody who has wisdom in one particular area, but maybe not in other areas. I know this is true about myself, right? There's some areas that I've worked through and feel like I have a little bit more clarity about and have a little bit more equanimity about, but I can see myself getting caught about other things as well. So that's true for all of us. So for our members in the community, we can just imagine by what a person says, what a person does, how we see their behavior, well, maybe they're people stuck in the mud around this particular issue. I don't think it's helpful to use broad generalizations about, oh, this person is a mud-stuck person. But just to see the, how they have perhaps some sensitivities in a particular area. So in this way, when we can see how we actually are wise persons and others are in the community, it's enormously helpful to live as part of what we can loosely call Sangha, or maybe in kind of our contemporary interpretation of Sangha, is those with whom we practice. And people who share our values and who appreciate the qualities that we are trying to cultivate here, who also think it's worthwhile to sit quietly in silence, who think it's worthwhile to not gossip, who think it's worthwhile to not take things that are not freely given to us, you know, to follow the precepts, to have a meditation practice. And it's helpful to practice in this type of a moral ecology and to interact with others who have this kind of shared values. And I like this idea of ecology because, right, when we look at ecological systems, each one has its own role, its own way that it participates. And then if you remove one element, right, there's consequences to that. And one element, each, and when you look in ecological systems, some may be prey and predator, right? There's like different roles for this, or some of the seeds of one tree may help something, another tree grow, but that other tree growing provides shade that doesn't let other things grow, right? I mean, there's just all these systems that interact. So it's not unidirectional. It's not only one thing influences another, but it's an entire system that kind of works together. And it's enormously helpful to be part of this system. I know when I was first practicing and first coming here to IMC, I became good friends with a person who had been coming here more often and was further along in the practice. And at the time, neither of us had jobs, so we would go have coffee, you know, like after Dharma talks. That was so helpful to just kind of talk with somebody like, what did they mean when they said this? Or, I don't like that. That made me feel uncomfortable. And this, do you really agree with this? Just to talk about it, right? It doesn't mean that we have to agree or have to exalt the teacher or something like that. But it does mean that we are engaged and that we're thinking about it. And we're not just that we hear something and then go off on our own way. Not all of us will have that opportunity to go sit with coffee, have somebody talk about Dharma talks. But my own experience is that it was enormously helpful to have somebody to engage with in this way. So I know that here at IMC, there's lots that kind of build on this. And for those whose schedules allow, there's on Wednesdays, there's a half-day retreat. And then afterwards, there's informal lunch. That's where I met a lot of people here at IMC, is lunch on those Wednesday afternoons. So I invite you, if your schedule allows or if you're interested, to come on Wednesday afternoons. Whether it's Wednesday half days, as well as the Dharma practice days on Fridays, or the Eightfold Path mentoring program. So these are all kind of ways in which IMC kind of helps to knit together community and create opportunities in which we can enter into this ecology of the Buddhist teachings here. And in addition, recently I was just on a retreat. Sue was on this retreat also. And this retreat was quite remarkable in a number of ways. But one was that a number of the sits in the hall, it was so quiet. And not only was it really quiet in the hall, I noticed that it was quiet in the dining hall, too. And there's something about when it's quiet, it just allows people to kind of settle in a different way. It doesn't always have to be quiet. There's a value in practicing when it's not quiet, too. But it was noticeable. And my job was to be part of the dishwashing team after the meal. And I've done this job before, and I'm often one of those people like, okay, let's get this done, right? And I just like, you know, like I want to get the dishes done as fast as possible. I know how to do this. I just want to get it done. And my dishwashing partner did not have the same idea about how to do the dishes. And as it happened, we split up the job so that there's one kind of essentially you could think of it as one who washes and one who dries. And she was moving so purposefully, you know, one dish, moving in, washing it, and putting it on the rack. And I found myself initially kind of like, wait, you know, come on, let's get to it. But it was remarkable. The way that she was moving, when she was really quiet, right? She wasn't kind of thrashing around with the water or the dishes. And it really helped kind of create this sense of quietness, a sense kind of a community that we were all sharing kind of this silence, as opposed to my idea of like, oh, who cares about the sound? We have to get to the sound fast. And I really appreciate it. It was a really good lesson for me, how kind of being in this micro community of just the two of us, and my seeing how the way I wanted to do things was different than the way she wanted to do, but how following the way that she wanted to do helped us support the greater community of there being some sense of quietness and ease in the dining hall, that there wasn't a real, you know, loud banging around going around. I thank her very much for that. That was a really useful lesson for me, to be sensitive to what's going on, and to respect how other people are behaving, how they're practicing, and to kind of put aside my idea, it's just an idea that things have to be done efficiently. When you're in retreat, things don't have to be done the most efficient. It's not like you have something to rush to go towards, right? To do next. So I've been talking about how our community can help us, wise people can point to us what is commendable, what can be condoned, as well as what is not wise action to do. We can imagine what is blamable and what are the consequences of what we do for others as for ourselves. That's one way to kind of be in community, to be influenced by them, by how to practice. But one other way that's kind of implicit in the teachings about how being in community can affect us is community can inspire us. There can be community members that we wish to emulate, that we can see that they have peers right on the outside. We don't necessarily know everybody's whole story. I would say we don't know anybody's whole story. We probably don't even know our own whole story. But that we can imagine that, oh, I'd like to have the ease that this person seems to have. I'd like to have the ability to sit still for an entire sit that this person seems to have. I'd like to have kind of the thoughtfulness or engagement that this person seems to have. So in this way, kind of like having a community of mixed people have been on that path further and people have been on that path longer, really helps us to see what's possible, to provide models of behavior, provide exemplars of what's possible. And one way that this is implicit in the Buddhist teachings is in something that I haven't heard talked about a lot here at IMC. And that is these particular meditation practices that aren't the usual ones. often hear it kind of in this whole scene here, quote-unquote, that includes, you know, Spirit Rock and kind of the Vipassana insight movement. We talk about insight or mindfulness or Vipassana meditation. They're all kind of, I'll use them as synonyms. Concentration meditation and loving-kindness meditation. But there's also a fourth kind in the Buddha Suttas, and that is recollection practices. So purposefully bringing to mind particular objects, intentionally bringing to mind particular objects. And there's a collection of these recollections. And two of them, I find, actually are about, my interpretation of them, are about being inspired, bringing to mind things that inspire us. And these things that inspire us can first get us to the cushion to do other practices if we want to, but also maybe can gladden our heart, can kind of uplift our heart if we're feeling like we've been watching the news way too much and it seems all grim and untenable or something. And so one of these recollections is the Sangha. And in this context, the word Sangha refers to those people who are ordained or have what in the kind of the early teachings they would talk about, have attainments, have tasted liberation, have some experiences of liberation. And they are, especially for those who have ordained, they are exemplars of a way of a life to embody freedom. You know, they've dedicated their life. They've decided, you know what, this is actually the most important thing, and I'm going to do this. I recently, just a few weeks ago, a friend of mine ordained as a monk, as a full monk. And I went to the monastery up at Abhayagiri just a few hours up north. It doesn't have in me this idea to become a nun. But I have to tell you, after being up there, being with the other monks and going through the ordination ceremony and talking to him before and talking to him afterwards, I started to have this feeling like, oh, wow, maybe there's, you know, something here that never had this entered my mind before. But just kind of seeing the ease and the peace and the simplicity, the incredible simplicity in which they live, kind of like lit a little idea inside me. And I wanted to kind of pay attention to that, not that I'm going to ordain, but how can I simplify my life? How can I figure out what are my priorities? So in the same way, when we see monks or nuns, it doesn't have to be that we have to emulate their lives perfectly, but are there aspects of that life, the way that they live, the practices they do, the things that they talk about that don't talk about, are there things that we can translate into our own lives? Can we take aspects of it? Can we take what we find inspiring from it and use it to kind of uplift our hearts and provide energy for our own practice and help us organize our own lives. And in this formal recollection practice of the Sangha, one of the things to recollect or, you know, bring to mind is that they have entered upon the good, the straight, and the proper way. That's kind of the language that's used in the suttas. So what is the good, straight, and proper way? It's just something for us to bring to mind, you know, how we define it and how do we think others are. And to bring to mind those people who are doing that. That appear to do that. Maybe I should say that, appear to do that, because we don't know people's interior lives. We don't know the whole story. But I think what's important here is what inspires us, not as what is actually true. Is this person 100% doing the good, proper way? But what can we use to guide us in our own practice? And then in these recollection practices, there's a second one that's about inspiration, which initially, when a person looks at it, doesn't seem like it is. But when I started to dig into it, I discovered that, oh, it's actually really about inspiration. And the way that it's listed, you know, how the Buddhists love lists, so the recollections in the list is called recollection of the deities, recollection of the devas, recollection of heavenly beings. And at first glance, that feels like, well, that's not necessarily in a person's worldview, maybe, may not be. But if they're not, then, like, what do you do with this? Like a recollection of heavenly beings. But when you look at it, actually the instruction is to recollect the qualities of these heavenly beings that enabled them to be in the heavenly realms. And to bring to mind, do I have these qualities as well that will help me have good positive results? So one way that we can interpret beings in heavenly realms are beings who have done actions that enable, that had good results. This brings us back to this idea of paying attention to the results of our actions. But the suttas are very specific. They talk about, so these beings who have good results, being born in heavenly realms, they have virtue, learning, generosity, and understanding. This is how they got there. This is how they got to these good results. And so the instructions are to bring to mind, well, just like these other beings had good results, I can have good results if I have virtue, learning, generosity, understanding. So in some way that can inspire us and can provide some energy for practice. But it doesn't provide energy for our practice or inspire us if we're filled with the word just slipped out of my mind. It's interesting. Oh, envy. If we're filled with envy, oh, that person can do this thing. They can sit still for a whole half hour. I can't sit still for a whole half hour. They can read the suttas. I don't like to read the suttas. Those things are boring. Or I don't understand them. Or, you know, they can be generous because look what they have to begin with. Or something, right? So it's not inspiring if we look at people who have these qualities if we're filled with envy. And instead, there's some teachings about this. Essentially says we have to do the work that others have done. So here's the Buddha giving a teaching to a person who wasn't a follower. And he says, suppose there were two tameable elephants that were well-tamed and well-disciplined, and two tameable elephants that were untamed and undisciplined. What do you think? Would the two tameable elephants that were untamed and undisciplined, and being untamed, would they acquire the behavior of the tamed? Would they arrive at the grade of the tamed? Would they be like the two elephants that were well tamed and well disciplined? No, venerable sir. So there's a lot of this word tamed in here. But right, the Buddha's kind of say, well, how do you think those elephants became tamed and disciplined? They had to be tamed and disciplined. They had to be worked. They had to work, and they had to probably be part of a community, which in the case of elephants may mean an elephant trainer. I imagine means other elephants in their community that they would emulate. I don't know, I haven't tamed elephants, but that's what I imagine. So something that's interesting, I think, in this little excerpt is this idea that these elephants are described, the adjective that's added to elephants are tameable. There are tameable elephants who are untamed, and there's tameable elephants who are tamed. What does it mean to be tameable? Before I answer that question, or before we address it, I'll add some more things. This idea of being tameable is descriptions of the Buddha. They're standard. They're sprinkled throughout the suttas, and it's part of the daily chanting practice for monks, for the way to these descriptions of the Buddha. And one of them, it's a list of things, and one is the Buddha is the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. So this idea of, people can be tamed. And how is he the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed? And here is another excerpt from another sutta. And this one, the Buddha is talking to a horse trainer named Casey. And he says to Casey, which I'll paraphrase here. Casey, how do you train horses? Well, some horses I train gently. Some horses I train sternly. Some horses I train both gently and sternly. And some horses can't be trained. And so I don't let them enter into the training. And then Casey, the horse trainer, goes on to say, and I kill those horses. So the Buddha says, in the same way, Casey, when I'm training those to be trained, I train some gently, I train some sternly, I train some gently and sternly, and some I kill. And Casey says, but wait, Tathagatas, the Buddhas, are not supposed to kill, and yet you just said that you killed. But this is a little bit unusual of the suttas. And the Buddha said, yes, I did. And Casey said, well, how do you kill these persons that you can't train? And he says, the person is destroyed because he is not spoken to or instructed by either me or the Sangha. And in this way, a person is destroyed. So he doesn't literally kill them, but if he did for I don't know what reasons, they're not given reasons, if they're untamable, then the Buddha himself doesn't talk to them, doesn't instruct them, and the community doesn't talk to them, doesn't instruct them. So in this way, kind of gets back to this idea of a community. So now I'd like to kind of come back to this idea, and I'd invite you to participate in this. What does it mean to be tameable? Who are these people that are tameable or able to be trained, either gently, sternly, both gently and sternly? How do we recognize that in ourselves, whether we're tameable or not, or what does that mean? So I'd like to open that up. I'd like to hear from you. What does it mean to be tameable? Yes?
I think it means the person...
Do you want to use the mic? Thanks.
I think it means the person has a desire to follow that path and to learn the skills. If they see no reason to participate, then I think that they would be pretty much shut down to learning those skills.
Excellent. Yeah, they have to kind of want to be on this path of practice. Great. Anything else? I thought of something like it's really obvious. The person has to be like conscious, right? Someone in a coma or something, right? We're not all of a sudden going to transform them to something else. They have to be able to understand in some way, right? They don't have to be the smartest person, but they have to have some kind of type of able to cognize, understand what's happening. That's kind of an obvious one. What else? Yeah, they need to have in some type of health. If you're really, really in agonizing pain, it's pretty difficult to learn something new, to have a new idea. Also, there may be, if you're in agonizing pain, you may be desperate and ready for something new, but there's, right, there has to be enough health that they have energy to embark on something new.
I think you have to be willing to give up control.
Can you say a little bit more? Control of what?
Just to be open that my way is not the only way. And I'm not controlling, you know, my own destiny. I'm open to the fact that someone else could actually be of benefit to me by opening up to a different perspective.
Yeah, I think you said a few things there. One is to recognize that maybe somebody has a good idea. Maybe we don't have all the answers. And I think kind of implicit in what you were saying was willingness to do things we haven't done before or to try things we haven't tried before. And maybe to kind of let go of control is also to have a certain willingness to be surprised. Instead of saying, oh, I know how this is going to be. I'm going to do this, and then this is going to happen, that's going to happen. I may as well not even bother. Instead to say, like, well, you know, maybe something can come from this, instead of anticipating that we know exactly what the outcome is going to be. Thank you, Sue.
Besides being open to change, I think we also have to be able to be disciplined and persistent in the process so that at the first sign of difficulty that we don't run for the door or bolt for the gate, you know, that we stick with it and can transcend those difficult periods. Because if we really are on the path, we're going to be tried by fire a lot of the time. A lot of pain and suffering have to be overcome in order to be purified, and we have to be able to be open to and allow ourselves to experience that to come out the other side. That's a very important factor, I think, too.
Yeah, you said quite a few things there, too, also. I think one was, like, just be open to change. Like, it's kind of an interesting thing, right? We want things to be different, yet we want them to be familiar often. So just to recognize that change means unfamiliar, as well as willing to put some effort, a little bit of energy. Sometimes we have more energy, sometimes we have less. Depends what's happening in our lives. But willing to, as best we can, put energy. Right? We're not asked to do things that are impossible. We're not asked to be somebody that we're not. We're not asked to do things that are seemingly impossible to do for us. We're asked just to consistent as best as we can do one thing. I know this, we can imagine that if you're standing in San Jose and you want to walk to San Francisco and you're imagining about San Francisco, you feel like, oh, I can't do that. I can't walk there today. Maybe you can. I don't know. I'm just making this up. but maybe if you can imagine that, well, but I can take the next step. I can just head north. And I can, like, take the next step. And then it's finally, if you just take the next step, then finally you find yourself in South San Francisco. And maybe from there you can say, oh yeah, okay, now I can imagine myself being in San Francisco. But you couldn't maybe imagine it when you were back at San Jose. So it's just that things become imaginable, possible as you go along. Actually, I want to add one more thing. So he kind of talked about energy, but in that was some persistence and some diligence, as well as not giving up. But what's being asked of us is only two things, right? Is to start and to continue. Right? And that continues just taking the next step rather than feeling like, oh my goodness, I can't do all of this. It's just to do the next step as best we can. Yes.
I thought you were, what you just said, touched on faith or something akin to faith that it will be beneficial. But When I think about the journey of 1,000 miles, I don't know whether you need faith in the ultimate goal or not. You're suggesting maybe you don't, that you just have to take the step, the first step, and then the next.
Yeah, so faith is talked about in a very interesting way in this tradition. Not in the way that maybe in the Judeo-Christian tradition, so they talk
right
about faith. And
try confidence.
Yeah, confidence. But faith definitely has a role. It's just not the same role. So maybe I'll say this small little thing about faith. I actually did a giant, as a part of my master's thesis, did a big thing about faith. That faith definitely is in the Buddhist path, but it's the beginning. It's not the end. It's the faith that kind of helps you do the next step of the thousand, journey of 1,000 steps, right? Do step number two. It's the faith is kind of what helps you just do that next step. And what do you have faith in? Lots of things, maybe, but faith that you have to have a certain confidence that what's being spoken about is possible. If you don't have that experience yet, you have to know that it is possible to have more ease, peace, well-being, freedom. And I would say that's partly where practicing in community helps. If we can see other people who appear to have that, teachers who have that, we can have faith that it is possible because, look, this person has done it. So it's not faith that's based on out of unsubstantiated belief. It's often more kind of substantiated. You want to add more?
The faith that the path is the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Or let's say this, faith that be willing to test your hypothesis that the faith, that path is the answer. Like, maybe you don't completely know, but you suspect, you anticipate, you imagine, so you're willing to take step number two after step number one, and then step number three, right? I mean, that's kind of how we go to college, because we believe it's a good thing for us. Maybe, you know, there's lots of reasons why, but right, any kind of like big endeavor, we believe, but you don't know until you actually experience it, right? I'm about being tameable. What about the idea of being willing to put some things aside? And where we are in the path and what's happening in our life, what those things are, will be different. But to, if we want to learn to swim, it's most helpful if we put aside our clothing that's really heavy, our shoes, right? And be willing to put on a swimsuit and get in the water, which is easier to swim in than our all our clothing or something, right? So to be able to put aside those things or to do this, to support us on this particular activity. And again, I'd like to emphasize that it doesn't have to be, we don't have to ordain and, you know, become monks and nuns. We don't have to do giant renunciation, but we do have to, just like this kind of idea of a path, we do have to be willing to do one thing, to put away those things that we can at that time, that's available to us to put away. We're not asked to do things that are seemingly impossible. We're not asked to be people that we're not. Just like walking from San Francisco to San Jose, maybe we can't imagine getting at San Francisco until we're at South San Francisco. Maybe in the same way, we can't imagine letting go of some things until we're further along the path. Just like my friend who got ordained, fully ordained. You know, I've known him for years. And I saw that first, you know, he was living in Berkeley, and then he wanted to save money, so he moved into a really tiny, actually a dorm room, and started to live in the community and gave away many of his possessions, not all of them, but just so that it would fit. And he, for years, lived there. And then he realized that he wanted to practice more, so he dedicated one day a week to do more practice, or one day every 2 weeks to do more practice. You know, and then he did that for years. And then he did something else, right? It was a long process for him to decide to become a monk. And I can imagine that he couldn't, I know this, he and I talked about it, that he could never imagine that he was going to become a monk, you know, 10, 15 years earlier. It's just like along the way, we put aside things that we can, that it makes sense, and that we can see clearly no longer serve us, no longer support us on the path. So in all these ways, we can be tameable. We can be one who can hears the teachings, put effort towards them, kind of be part of this path, as well as be part of a community. Then enter this ecosystem of a kind of a community that practices in this way and have them support us on the path. And just like we are supported, we support others. By our creating this community here on a Tuesday morning, and right, it's easier to sit here for 35 minutes when there's other people sitting here for 35 minutes. We all can contribute to this. So with that, I wish you all a wonderful day, and whatever kind of path you find yourselves on today, may it be filled with either you are being in a community that kind of supports you on your path, or you're helping create a community that supports you on the path. And maybe you kind of consider how can you be tameable, either for yourself, or maybe you can help somebody else be tameable, I don't know. Thank you.